It's an honor and a privilege for me to introduce Senator Marco Rubio to you this evening. I've had the pleasure of knowing Senator Rubio since March of 2000, and what I can say about Senator Rubio is that he was a textualist and he was an originalist long before it was cool. In a world of a Jacksonian populism, we need a leader in the United States Senate that advocates for the separation of power and the proper role of all three branches of government, and we are fortunate that we have such a leader in Senator Marco Rubio. Senator Rubio was interviewed by the Florida Bar News in 2005 about the proper role of the judicial branch, and this is what he said. "I believe in the judiciary and its ability to function independent of political coercion. I'm a jealous guardian of that. I'm an equally jealous guardian of the legislative branch's role, and I don't believe it's the role of judges to create law. I don't believe it's the role of judges to subvert legislative will." Senator Rubio brought his judicial philosophy to the 2016 presidential race, where he stated on the campaign trail in New Hampshire, "My criteria for appointing justices, not just Supreme Court justices, but judges at the appellate level, every level of government, are people that adhere to the Constitution, that view the role of an appellate judge to apply the Constitution, not to creatively manipulate it, not to creatively spin it to reach a policy conclusion they want." Senator Rubio has also stood up to executive branch overreach while Speaker of the Florida House. When Governor Crist sought to expand casino gambling in the state, then Speaker Rubio filed a lawsuit to block the move, arguing the governor had overstepped his authority by not getting the legislature's approval. The Florida Supreme Court sided with then Speaker Rubio. Recently, the Federalist Society has gotten a tremendous amount of positive press about its role as a thought leader, articulating the proper function of all three branches of government. As you can see from the above, Senator Rubio has been echoing this message for years. So tonight, we are not just welcoming Senator Rubio to the Federalist Society, we are here to thank him for being an originalist, a textualist, and a conservative long before the majority of people had ever heard of the Federalist Society. Senator Rubio.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thank you, guys. I was just telling someone a few minutes ago that I'm still a member of the bar, and one of the main reasons why is because apparently I didn't know this until about a year ago. I said, "Well, why am I still paying these bar fees? I can't practice law. I forgot most of it anyway." And their answer was, "Well, if you don't pay and it lapses, you got to take the bar exam again." And I swore, on the day I took that exam at the Tampa Convention Center, I said, "I will never sit for a test for the rest of my life." This is so. That promise cost me, what is it, $220 or something? But I don't check any of the boxes. That's my rebellion. I'm just paying the fee. I'm not paying any extra. So anyway, and and now I get a nasty letter from the bar or something. You're under investigation for defaming the bar, whatever. So they can't kick you out, right? If you're not practicing, as long as I pay my fee, they can't kick me out. All right, good. Tomorrow you'll hear from my colleague, Mike Lee of Utah, a phenomenal guy. I think you'll enjoy very much. He truly lives and breathes this stuff and has actually published two books about the Constitution, about what's happening in our government. So what I wanted to do in our limited time here, and I see the microphones. Is there a question portion of this? No? Good. But yeah, I've been behind a lot of podiums over the last year and a half with a lot of damn questions, and but there are like 18 other people on the stage with me. One of them is the president. So. But I'm more than happy to answer them if they are. So what I wanted to do in our brief time together is kind of break it up into two realms. The first is kind of the issues before us, both in Florida and nationally, because I think we have an extraordinary opportunity here with the nomination of Judge Gorsuch to the Supreme Court. And then the broader context of why this all matters, because I think that second part we haven't talked about enough. So let me begin with the first. The first is in Florida. As you know, we've got numerous vacancies and hopefully an expansion here in our state. because we do have judicial emergencies. We have grown much faster in our state, and we've become increasingly a forum for a lot of federal litigation and, of course, criminal action as well. And so we do really have needs here. But and what I really wanted to do today is kind of send the word forth that we're looking for really good people that are hopefully willing to step forward and serve their country on the bench. And I'm not just looking for good people. I'm looking for good people with the right frame of, in terms of their understanding of what their job would be. I think if someone comes to you and says, I really want to change public policy, I really want us to move in this direction or that direction as a country, if that's what moves you, if that's what you're passionate about, you should run for the legislature. You should run for Congress. If you're interested in ensuring that the Constitution of the United States is applied and that the statutes written by Congress are appropriately applied, even if you disagree with the policy outcome, then those are the kinds of people we're looking for. And we're also looking for people that are going to be there a while, because the one thing we do have an opportunity to do is to put a stamp on the judiciary for years to come. And again, a lot of people on the left would say, oh, they're trying to take over the judiciary and make it more conservative. And that's a word we throw around loosely. It's not about making it more conservative. It's about making it more constitutional, about ensuring that the people that are in the judiciary at the federal level are people that understand what the role of the judiciary is in this very delicate balance that some incredible geniuses established over 240 years ago. And so I hope that we can go out and encourage some people to step forward, and some of them may be on the bench now, some of them may be in private practice or teaching. We're open-minded about that. And I also want people that are gonna be there a while, as I said, because for us that to be able to put that. And by the way, I'd love to have people that you could envision one day being a nominee to a higher court, the people that have the conditions, whatever it may be, that will allow them to one day be considered beyond what their initial entryway into the federal judiciary would be. And so we're still working through that process. As many of you are aware, there's a judicial nominating commission that's been in place for about 30 years. People have mixed views on it. But the most important part of that is it's solely and almost entirely dependent on the willingness of the White House to say that they will limit their choices to the two or three names that you send them. In the absence of that agreement, then the JNC really becomes an advisory panel, but doesn't have much weight, and it may even be a big waste of time. So it's not that the White House has said they're for it or against it, it's more along the lines of they're like been there 12 days, they've done a lot in 12 days, and they're gonna be really busy over the next few months. So that my hope is that we can really encourage people that you may know, or maybe one of you, think about the opportunity to do that in the years to come. Because we do, one thing is to advocate for the right choices. Another is to step forward and offer yourself as one of those right choices. And I do think public service is an incredibly rewarding and fulfilling experience if it in fact fits what's going on in your life and you're passionate about it. The second is the Supreme Court nomination, I believe, is an extraordinary educational opportunity for our country. And I find it disturbing that by and large today in America, there is a fundamental misunderstanding of the role of the Supreme Court. I hear people come up to me and say, well, we want someone that's compassionate. And I like compassionate people. Or we want someone that's open-minded, and I like that too in people. And those are not bad attributes to have as a human being. They're actually pretty good attributes to have as a policymaker. And they certainly aren't things that would disqualify you from being on the Supreme Court. But quite frankly, they're not the job of the Supreme Court justice. And so when people think that we're appointing people because of the things they believe in, the most important thing they need to believe in is not a specific public policy outcome. It has to be whether they truly understand that their job is not to be a trier of fact, but a trier of the law. To look at the case before them and reach a conclusion about whether or not the government, in many cases that's the government being challenged, has the power to do what they did. And that's why Justice Scalia from time to time would reach these conclusions that ran counter to probably what his personal beliefs were. Because Justice Scalia understood that that wasn't his job. He may disagree with the outcome, but he was prepared to say that it was wrong. It's why I've always said to people when they talk about executive orders, look, I'm in favor of reducing the tax burden in America. But if tomorrow the president signs an executive order saying, I order the IRS to only collect 25%, even though the legislative language says 35%, I agree with the policy outcome, but I would oppose the executive action because it undermines the separation of power, the constitutional duties assigned to each office. And that's the kind of justices we need. And so this is an important opportunity for us to really educate the American people about the proper role of the court. And there's this sense out there that the court are basically this panel of super legislators designed to supervise and clean up whatever mistakes are made at the policy realm by the president or by the Congress. And we really need to correct that, or we're going to wind up in a very bad place as a country, where the Constitution becomes a bunch of words on an ancient document that no longer have any meaning in our daily lives. And I think that really begins by explaining to people the importance of the Constitution in and of itself. Because oftentimes we talk about how important the Constitution is in the same way that we tell people it's good to eat broccoli. It's good for you. It's a good thing. But we don't explain why it's a good thing. The purpose of the Constitution is not to empower government, but to limit its power, because it was written and designed by people who had had a pretty bad experience with centralized government. They came to the conclusion, rightfully so, that all human beings are deeply flawed, and that given enough power, those flaws will turn into abuses, tyranny, or really bad ideas. And so they were very distrustful of governmental power. They're not anarchists, but they were distrustful of the power of government, and they were distrustful of the concentration of power in the hands of one individual or a small number of individuals. So they designed this system that, if you look at it, you can only conclude they didn't want this system to do very much, because they created an executive with the power to carry out the laws. They created a legislative branch that itself was divided into two very different bodies, a Senate that for many years, over 100-something years, wasn't even elected by the general public, it was elected by the legislatures, and a House that ran every 2 years, so they gave it two very different settings, and then a court to oversee whether or not any of these two branches were stepping out of their proper lane in the Constitution. It was designed as a document of limitation. It also, by the way, limited the power of the federal government very specifically. It basically said, here's the list of things the federal government has power over. If it's not on this list, you don't have that power. It belongs to the states. And that was very wise, and we'll talk about that in a moment, as to why the loss of that has had an impact on our society. And so we have to explain that to people. It's important. This is a perfect opportunity to do it, because there's going to be a lot of talk out there about people basically debating a Supreme Court nominee the way you would a presidential candidate. And that's not the case here. And I hope that we can recapture that and make that argument and explain to people why this is important. Because everyone that's nominated to the Supreme Court goes to a really good law school. Everyone who's nominated to the Supreme Court is very intelligent. Even the ones that whose views on the proper role of the court we don't agree with, no one here would say that anybody on the court isn't an intellectual giant capable of analyzing issues. They're all very smart people. So that's a given. You're going to get really smart people. That alone is not enough. Do they understand the proper role of the Supreme Court in our constitutional system? And are they prepared to rule along those lines? And that, to me, is what's essential. What I'm excited about this nomination is that if all things go well, I mean, this is a person who's going to be there for 30 years. That's a lot of presidents. That's a long time. That's three full terms of a presidency and beyond. Many of the people that will vote for his nomination will not be alive by the time he steps down from the court, if all things work out well. Not me, I intend to still be around in 30 years, but some of the other people in the Senate may not be around if the actuarial tables are correct. And my point is that I don't mean that in a mean way. I mean that is to make a point as to how important this is. And then I want to say why the broader point is so important. And if you look at where America stands today, the consolidation of governmental power has had a devastating impact on every aspect of our lives. And it really tracks right back to the loss of federalism. Hence the name of this organization, the Federalist Society. I don't think this country has ever needed it more than it needs today. Because while we are still a country and we are united by some basic principles that should unite us, the great challenge of America is we've never been a nation founded on a common ethnicity or a common race, or common religion, even a common background in terms of our ancestry. What's kind of united us as a nation is a commitment to an idea, the notion that all people have a God-given right to life, to liberty, and to pursue happiness. That's a very powerful idea, and by the way, a very revolutionary one, because up until about 200 some odd years ago, that notion didn't exist. Your rights were whatever the government said they were. And we created a system to protect that. But if you look at how diverse America is today, I would just say to you that the presidential campaign brought that to light. I would campaign during the week in Iowa, which is a great place, and then I would go to New York to raise money. The people in Iowa don't understand what planet the people of New York are from. And the people of New York don't believe the people from Iowa exist because they don't know anyone like them. That's how diverse our country is. Our problems are also diverse. And the notion that somehow we can design one-size-fits-all solutions for a country as complex and as diverse as ours is ridiculous. And the best example of that is the failure of our anti-poverty programs to cure poverty. There's no doubt that our anti-poverty programs are important. And there's no doubt that they alleviate the pain of poverty, but they don't cure it. And one of the fundamental reasons why they don't cure it is because the underlying factors that are holding back Americans, quite frankly, sometimes are different, even in a state like Florida. If you go visit poverty in South Dade or in rural areas of the state, they're very different than the causes and the root behind poverty in the urban areas. And even among urban areas, they're different. And yet somehow we believe that this government in Washington, run by supposedly enlightened technocrats, is going to be able to come up with this perfect solution that applies just as good in San Francisco as it does in Mississippi. It's absurd. And the other thing that I would say is, it crowds out competition. It would benefit our society to have multiple jurisdictions, not just 50 states, but local entities competing with one another to see who can come up with the best ideas. Why is that competition good? I know a lot of good reasons. If you come up with a great innovation to your school system in Florida, people will move here. People move to Florida because we don't have an income tax. They move for the weather, but they move for no income tax. They move for a lot of reasons. People will move from one state to the other because that state has better policy ideas. And it's not like these states are being governed by dictators. They're being run by accountable, electable individuals. And if you don't, elected individuals, if you don't like the policy decisions made by the state legislature, you can vote them out of office. You can vote yourself a new governor. That concept isn't just constitutional. It now has become common sense. And we have abandoned it in this country. And so we're shocked when these massive federal programs that aren't just unconstitutional, but illogical, don't work. And so more than ever before, this nation needs a return to federalism, not because we're indifferent. That is the danger. When we talk about turning over programs and responsibilities to states and localities, sometimes we have to be careful to make very clear, it's not that we're trying to wash our hands of this. It's not that we're saying we don't care about these issues. If they're important, let the states figure it out. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that because I care about these issues, because I care deeply about improving access to quality education, because I care deeply about how much college is costing people today, because I care deeply about the fact that we've got millions of Americans trapped in a cycle of generational poverty, because I care deeply about these things, I want the answers to these problems to be as close to these problems as possible. I want to bring the solution and the problem as close in proximity as I possibly can. Because I believe that if you empower people at the state and local level to confront these issues, they're going to come up with creative solutions that work for them and may serve as a model for other places. But the judiciary is critical in all that. It's critical in all that because it has been, quite frankly, compliant, complacent, and in many ways cooperated with this centralization of governmental power. And you saw that in the Obamacare rulings, where so many provisions in that law are clearly in violation of the limitations on the federal government. But somehow they, nevertheless, on a 5-4 vote, our country now faces this massive program that is failing because it once again is trying to impose on a diverse country with a rapidly evolving economy a one-size-fits-all approach from Washington, D.C. And so the very concept of federalism, embedded in our Constitution, defended supposedly in our court system, and adhered to by our legislators, has had dramatic economic and social impacts on our country. And so that's why this is so critical. That's why this is so important. And that's why I think this will have an enormous impact on the future of our country. And I hope we can get back to that point, because we desperately need it. And I will close with this. There's a lot of negativity about the state of affairs in America today. I would say that no society as angry at one another as this one is can possibly prosper. You just can't. I don't care. You cannot find me an example of any nation in human history where 50% of the people hate the other 50% of the people and somehow they still do well. If you've got an airplane or a ship where half the passengers are fighting with the other half the passengers and the pilots jumped into the fight too, that plane's going to crash and everyone's going to die. Well, I'm not saying America's going to die, but I am saying that this kind of deep divisions that exist in our society, where we no longer have debates about public policy, we skip that. If we don't agree with you on an issue, forget it. We don't even debate the merits of your idea. You're a bad person. You're just a horrible human being. Somehow we got to walk back and off that precipice. And I think those of us in public office have a responsibility to be more cautious in the way we address issues and the way we talk about one another in that regard. But the other is this. if you think about where we stand today as a country, we are living through this extraordinary transformation, social and economic, and it isn't going to stop. It's never going to be the 1950s again. A lot of people on the left want it to be 1965 again. 1965 ain't coming back, nor is 1980 for that matter. Thank God, because those, what are those pants? Remember the big parachute pants? Some of you are too young to know what I'm talking about. They were nasty, man. Those things should be illegal forever. They're unconstitutional, actually. But we're not going back. We just can't. Whether we like it or not, we live in a global economy. Whether we like it or not, automation is here to stay. Whether we like it or not, America's strategic strength is in manufacturing things on the high end of the scale, and those jobs pay a lot more. That's just the way it's going to be. We can fight against the future, but the future always wins. And so our challenge is, do we embrace that future? Do we address the problems that it's creating and benefit from the opportunities? Or do we allow it to leave us behind the way nations and societies and cultures have been left behind by changes forever? If you went back in a time machine 100 years ago, the most powerful nation on earth was Great Britain, unchallenged, unrivaled. Less than 100 years later, they're a fantastic country and a great ally, but they are no longer the most powerful nation on earth because a combination of wars and change left them behind. That can't happen to, it could, that can happen to us. It doesn't have to happen to us, but it could. And so we have to confront these challenges and embrace these opportunities. And we don't have forever to do it. And that's something, and I don't believe that we can do that unless we return to the principles of federalism, until we decentralize the concentration of power at the federal government, until we begin to trust people at the local and state level through their elected representatives to find innovative and creative solutions to problems that government in Washington has failed to be able to solve, until we use our diversity not as something that divides us, but as something that strengthens us. Because diversity doesn't just mean that we like different music or different cities or hold different political views. Diversity also means you've got different ideas. Look at all these extraordinary innovations that people have come up with that are rapidly transforming our economy on a daily basis. They're a direct result of the fact that we are a diverse nation, where people are encouraged to think outside the box and are constantly dreaming about changing the world. And you may wonder, well, why does all have, some people would say, what does that have to do with the federal judiciary and the courts and the Federalist Society and things they care about? Because at the end of the day, the reason why some of that was even possible is because we had a system of government that allowed that to be possible, that allowed, to the extent the government, that number one, understood the proper role of our government. And that is a limited role, not because we're indifferent, but because we care. And we understand that when government crowds out institutions in society that could do a better job than we can, we put them out of business. When government competes with the family, when government competes with the faith community, when government competes with civil society, when government competes with all of these institutions that teach people how to be people, okay? Because laws can tell you what's legal, they can't tell you what's right. Values have to be taught and instilled. And when government competes with those institutions or crowds them out, they can't do that. And that's how you become a country where 19-year-old young men spray houses with bullets without any regard for what's happening. And so that's why the proper role of government is so important. We have a constitutional system that is designed to limit the power of the federal government, limit the power of government in general, and that always asks the fundamental question, is this the role for government? And if it is, what level of government is it most appropriately dealt with? And we've lost that balance. And I wish I could tell you that's because of the Democrats. It's because of both of them. Because even now, what most of the debates are about is the Democrats want to move us to big government, and the Republicans want a big government that works better than the big government. It's more efficient, costs a little less, but it's a big government nonetheless. Being against big government is not believing that we have issues we should address. It's believing that we do have issues that we address, and they're often best addressed by society. And if it's government that needs to address them, they're often best addressed by the school board, or the county commission, or the city council, or the state government. We've got to get back to that, and we will need a judiciary that believes that in order to achieve that. And that's why it's so critical that we continue the activism that you've made in allowing Florida to become a model for the country of how we can get people that believe in these concepts to be willing to step forward and serve their country on the bench. And so I thank you for all you've done and continue to do. I look forward to working with many of you in many different capacities, and I hope that even as I'm talking to you here now, there might be a couple of you that will soon be before us as a potential federal judge. If you've lost your mind and you want to be that, it's a good job. Yeah. No, I'm kidding. I'm joking. I hope that I can encourage you to pursue that path, or maybe an elected office. But if you have the time and you have the passion and you have the circumstances in your life that allow it, I hope some of you will be interested in serving your country in public office, whether it's on the bench or in elected office, because our nation desperately needs people of strong principles and values to step forward and serve us at this critical time. And my last parting thought is, I think we're gonna be okay. It's gonna be rough, it's always been. We've never had an easy time in our history. The 60s were rough, the 70s were rough. You know, gas lines, Watergate, disco music. These were tough things that we had to confront. But we've always had generations willing to step forward and do what needs to be done. It's just our turn. And I believe we can, and I pray that we will. And if we do what needs to be done, we're gonna be able to leave our children and grandchildren as the freest and the most prosperous Americans that have ever lived. And that, to me, is a prospect that excites me and drives me. It's one of the reasons why I changed my mind and decided to run for re-election. And I hope it's one of the reasons that will encourage some of you to decide at the appropriate time in your life to step forward and serve your country in public office in the capacity that you best see fits. So thank you again for the chance to talk to you. Thank you.